I do have this material. The idea is that you can maybe take some notes, follow along to some extent. I do feel an obligation, since a whole night has passed, to review a little bit, and maybe somehow looking at things at the top level will make it make a little more sense. So help me out. It'll make me feel better if somebody else answers. Where did we start yesterday? What was kind of the beginning point of our study of men's roles? Yeah, we started the creation, really, even before the fall, but the fall had an obvious impact on that as well. And I guess I'm trying to assert, though I don't fully understand it, I keep confessing my ignorance, and I think that life and its lessons, study of God's word and further comprehension, maybe some of these things will be clearer, but I do think God created men different from women and ideally suited for the roles he gave them throughout time, including after the fall. I think there were things put in men that helped them when they were told to subdue the world, have dominion over the creation, to tend the garden, whatever that meant, to be one flesh with Eve, all that in that ideal world. I think there were characteristics men had different from women, ideally suited for that. And when the fall came and those consequences came, those same qualities, right, which might have included things like the ability to plan and reason and push for a goal and be success-oriented and to appreciate proper recognition, and actually to be courageous and take on challenges and be satisfied when those challenges are met. I think men are kind of unique in those, some of those ways, maybe more than women. But those things also, in addition to suiting us for what God has placed us in the world to do, they also create opportunities for challenges, temptations. It is the case, you know, Satan has no new tools. He can only use the virtues, the characteristics God has given us, and try to twist them into something else. And so the temptation to cruelty or aggression or violence or temper in which we act in an uncontrolled way or intimidation or in some way where the idea of accomplishment gets twisted into the idea of oppressing others, taking from others, serving ourselves, satisfying our own desires, that may be a special temptation men have in a way that women don't have. I don't fully understand all that, but I believe that general statement is true. So we've looked at some of that and try to examine our own character. Have we let some of those male qualities turn into temptations in the way we treat others, in priorities we've set in the world, in our own self-control and other things like that? And yet, we need to find the ways that we apply them the right way, if you really believe that's part of the story too. And we've introduced some of those things. I hope there may be puzzles to you. God made men to be soldiers, and he told the ones that are fearful, don't show up. How does that apply? How does that apply? And yet we're kind of, a lot of these characteristics, especially with regard to the women as the weaker vessel, have to do with kindness and people-orientedness and sympathy and those kind of things. So I hope you're wrestling with that, because I think that's part of it. Same thing with parents, being a father to a son. How do you toughen him up if that's what you think? You know, how does that flow? We'll get into some of that today. So that's where we are. We didn't finish, and I think I despair of getting to elders, probably even maybe much of the discussion of teachers in the church. I'd like to get as far as the definition of leadership in Jesus' teaching, but that's where we'll get to. Is this going to come up? Did I blank it out? So last night we were in the end of the third module, and if you want to find the page, it's probably page 8. Now, I just wanted to say a word, because we got to this forbearance and forgiveness, and I jumped ahead, and I wanted you to think overnight about the self-assessment that looks at the three qualities or three areas and characteristics: spirituality, selflessness or sacrifice, and or the last one was skills and strength. Let's talk about that. Colossians 3, turn there. That'd be a place to start. We can just look at our Bibles. There's a similarities between Colossians and Ephesians. There's a similar passage in Ephesians 4 that leads into the discussion of unity. But it also seemed like this might play the role of that passage in Ephesians 5 where it says submitting yourselves one to another that leads into the discussion of men and women. You remember that? I'm sure Colossians is in here. This is my Bible that's hard to find. Turn pages. Colossians 3, verse 12, therefore, as the elect of God, holy and beloved, put on tender mercies, kindness, humility, meekness, long-suffering, bearing with one another, or forbearing one another is another word. That's a special Greek word. And forgiving one another, as anyone has a complaint against another, even as Christ forgave you, so you must also do. Notice the near context, verse 18, you get into that passage. It's very similar to Ephesians 5, where the husband and wife roles are discussed. A little bit different language. So I would like to think about the forgiveness process for just a minute. So let's go back. First thing that happens is wrong is done. And we'll call this by the sinner who does the wrong. And they hurt me, right? And I have now a debt that is owed to me because I have suffered because of the sin of someone else, right? But in the ideal, they come and this, oh, by the way, that goes on the list. I have a debt. It's a debt. The sinner repents, right? In fact, they not only repent, they come and they ask for forgiveness. They come to me and ask for forgiveness. And I forgive them. Isn't that what Jesus said to do? How many times in a day? How many times in a lifetime? 70 times 7. No more, of course, but that's a guideline that he gave us, right? So I ask for forgiveness. And if I'm Christ-like as I should be, I grant forgiveness to the by the victim. I'm the victim to this sinner who has come to ask for forgiveness. And then the relationship is restored, but not before, right? Because they have a debt that's not been paid. Is this our picture of forgiveness sometimes? You've ever heard the question, can you forgive somebody if they never ask you for forgiveness? You ever heard that? I've heard a whole half of a Bible class spent on that discussion. How can you do that? They haven't asked for forgiveness. I can't forgive them. Yeah, come. That's an interesting line, isn't it? They certainly weren't asking for forgiveness at that point, were they? So what's wrong with this picture? What's wrong with this picture? Pardon? Yeah, that's one thing that's wrong. In fact, Matthew 18 kind of describes a situation where I might be aggressive about going to try to seek that person out and help them come to their senses. And if that doesn't work, what do I do? I get some more people, and then I finally get the whole church involved. And that's good because we got them, now we really got them exposed, and they have to ask for forgiveness then, right? And maybe they deserve that because they hurt me so bad. You know, they deserve that embarrassment and that humiliation. Yeah. I know. But isn't that fair? They're the one that did the bad thing. Profoundly said, yeah, who is the burden on? Who bears the burden in? Yes, keep.
If we are wrong by anyone, it is our duty as a Christian to forgive them, whether they ask for forgiveness or not. And that's more Christ-like. If you're going to this individual with a saying, I want you to admit what you did wrong,
yeah. Could be, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
If you forgive, then you're being more Christ-like.
Yeah, yeah. That.
So,
So I think we should keep in mind there's a relationship with God that plays into this. I think that's important. Yep. Does that bother you? Is there any passage that says love does not keep account of evil? If I remember right, that's actually an accounting term, isn't it? Which implies there's a list. And that list can get pretty long. In fact, sometimes it might be hard to keep track of. In fact, have we checked off everything or not? Or have I still got some things on that list? And Yeah. Sure. Actually, leave your sacrifice at the altar.
Yeah.
If you think somebody... So there's this encouragement that we should all be sensitive to taking the initiative when there's some kind of a personal issue at stake here, where I have been wronged in some way. Here are some other problems with that model. What if it's not a sin? You know what I mean? I mean, I'm hurt. Somebody steps on my toe, but it was an accident. It hurts just as bad as if they stomped on it intentionally, but I don't... And what if it's not clear which it is? And that never happens, does it, in a marriage relationship where it's not clear what the intent is, but I'm somehow inconvenienced and it's some type of a burden and I wish the person weren't this way. Y'all see what I'm talking about? I think more situations are like that than the clear, that one goes on the list, right? This is jeopardizing this person's soul and I have to take responsibility to, you know, save a soul from death and cover a multitude of sins. Is that your daily life in a marriage when you have disagreements or issues or things that annoy you or that cause you harm or whatever? I'm probably exaggerating the question to some extent, but I think there's something a little wrong about formalizing this too far and saying, well, there's morality involved here, so I have to put it on the list, or else I'm you know, letting a person, a sinner, off without... Okay. Sure. Yeah.
The other word is pride.
Mm-hmm.
Pride can also interfere with forgiveness
process. Yeah. Well. One more. I need to. Yeah, this is good. Yeah. Yes.
So I'm looking at. It seems like the bottom line is to restore that relationship.
Yeah.
Whether you're the victim.
Yeah.
Whether you're the sinner.
Yeah.
You should do whatever you can, regardless if you think it's a sin or not.
Yep. Yes. Right. Exactly. Not separate the relationship, that kind of thing. So I'll actually go to this passage again. Forbearing, a different Greek word, forbearing with one another and forgiving one another. Those two words are paired several times. In Ephesians, they're also paired, as I mentioned before, in the first part of chapter 4. They seem to go together. How is forbearing related to forgiveness? It might help to know what forbearing means. There's a Greek word for that. It literally means to hold oneself up against, to put up with, to bear, to endure, to forbear, and to suffer. And Sharon translated some different ways, probably related to the word, often interchangeable with long suffering, but it's related to that. It's the quality of self-restraint. And the reason I put this particular definition... Do you remember the macho man again? What happens when he's slightly nudged? What's his reaction? I'm going to teach you not to do that again, right? And I'm going to take vengeance sevenfold, right? Or 77 or something like that. But here, self-restraint in the face of provocation, which does not hastily retaliate, promptly punish, it's the opposite of anger, it's associated with mercy. The problem I have with that model of forgiveness, that, you know, strict model, I can't let them off the hook if God doesn't let them off the hook kind of thing, is that puts the sinner, it puts the victim in a place of power. I think that's your point about humility. It puts me in a place where a debt is owed, and I carry that around as a kind of a lever, a brickbat, a hammer, right? And it can destroy the relationship just as surely, perhaps more so, for me to carry that debt owed me around as a barrier to the relationship as it might be the original provocation itself. So maybe forbearance is something less than forgiveness. Or is it more than forgiveness? Or does it apply when it's not really a deep sin or not? So, I don't know. Here's a little thought experiment. Which would you think, forbearance or forgiveness? Here's one. Your spouse is too short, and that inconveniences you. That goes on the list for sure, right? Lies to you over a minor matter. You know what the next one's going to be, probably. Lies to you over a major matter, right? Now what? Has a habit that annoys you. That falls in the category of being too short, perhaps. And one example for wives would be that my husband is withdrawn. He won't communicate with me. Is that something that needs forgiveness or forbearance? Kind of easy for us to see because that's usually the problem we have, right? What about someone who annoys me with questions and criticisms all the time because they're trying to draw me into a closer relationship? You see those are two sides, but it might feel like it's, and you know, judging intent before, right? How that would be. I'm not going to answer these. It continues that annoying habit that we talked about earlier after you ask them to stop. Now they know. Now it's intentional, right? They keep, blowing their nose without proper covering or something. I don't know. And I ask them to stop, and they continue to do that, and it's annoying me, right? They accidentally lose a large amount of money. They intentionally waste a large amount of money. This is waste in my view, right? Disagrees that he or she has done something wrong after intentionally wasting a large amount of money, right? And continues in an immoral habit. Okay, and then accuses you falsely before others. I hope I'm generating a little bit of confusion here. And that is, it isn't quite so clear when I have to put something on the list, or maybe even when I have to confront someone and say, you know what, our relationship is broken until you fix this and straighten it out. I'd like to show you a couple of passages that have to do with forbearance, if they'll come up. And they have to do with God's forbearance, same word. God set forth Jesus as a propitiation by his blood through faith to demonstrate his righteousness because in his... God passed over the sins that were previously committed. What? What was God forbearing? Was he forbearing like we were too short and we made it inconvenient? Or was he forbearing rebellion and sin against him? Now, there was a plan at work, right? There was something that was going to come and fix that. And yet, for a long time, and I have to say in my own life, God forbears, waiting, hoping maybe that there'll be a change, looking for some improvement. And he blesses and he sends the rain and the sun on the just and the unjust, as Jesus said. You know what I mean by that? Kind of an interesting way to think about it. Be diligent to be found by him in peace without spot and blameless. 2 Peter 3, the idea of the coming judgment, seeing that these things are all about to be destroyed. And consider that the long suffering of our Lord is what? Why isn't he just destroying the world? And when we sin, breaking off the relationship. What's his point in doing that? Trying to get one more. He wants all men to come to repentance, not that any should perish. Do you think this, O man, Romans 2, you who judge those practicing such things and doing the same, by the way, terrible people. These are the ones not like the Gentiles, perhaps, in chapter 1. They know the law. They know that this shouldn't be done. They know those things are worthy of death. He said, do you despise the riches of his goodness, forbearance, and long-suffering? Do you see what's happening in God's plan with us? He is overlooking some pretty terrible things. Not overlooking them in the sense that ultimately we're not accountable, but he has a purpose in doing that, and it's some kind of a restoration. And you know, in some ways, I think the idea that all those things are each going on God's list is the wrong picture too. I think when we turn and we've long forgotten all those acts of rebellion and we say, I've got to fix this relationship, God welcomes us back. We don't have to pull the list out and make sure we, you know, ask for each one. This is what I think the picture is. And all those sins in the previous ages of, dispensations, you know, were covered in some way. Okay, I hope you can see where I'm going with this. And that is, I think we take forgiveness as a brickbat, a lever, and so on. And I think even some of the most serious sins might be something we ought to forbear. With what purpose? Just tolerance of evil? Compromise? What's the point? I want to have this relationship because that's your only hope to help you. Even if it's a terrible thing. At the same time, if it's a minor thing, I'm not going to let it spoil the relationship either. Maybe even more so, right? It shouldn't be a breaking of the relationship. And even if it maybe does reflect some immaturity, imperfection, call it sin, whatever you want. Now, I'm going to say there are exceptions, of course, but I hate exceptions because they tend to tear down the rule. I'll tell you what they are. If someone's soul is immediate jeopardy, like a continuing immorality, I think that's got to be addressed because it's affecting others, it's a serious sin, it destroys the relationship, it has to be brought forward. And I think that's what Matthew 18 is about. And the goal of Matthew 18 is you've gained your brother. You put the relationship back together, right? Meaning it was torn apart. And God has been, they've been reconciled with God. I think those are the two things that call for immediate addressing of particular wrongs. And that is a soul in jeopardy or not? And this is the best way to address it. And does our relationship, is it in jeopardy? If it is, I got to go to them. And that's the passage, whoever brought that up, the other half of it, right? Whether I'm the wronged or the wronger, right, then I've got to go fix that. If I've broken a relationship, that's where confrontation is required.
I do agree with what you said on the merits, but I think the other issue here in the relationship is things done in ignorance, things done intentionally.
Yeah.
Because sometimes if you're in the relationship with your spouse, you know, as far as husband and wife, I may do things where they don't know they've done something wrong. Mm-hmm. And it's grinding on you, but it's nothing major. That's the forbearance. But if they do it purposefully, over and over again, even like you said a minute ago, sin of immorality. I mean, that has to be addressed right off the bat. I mean, that is intentional. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's ignorant. I think it's intentional. But that's my opinion.
Yeah. Okay. I would probably take a softer view, even. And only because I think sometimes intentional things are things that we should forbear. And by our forbearance, especially if they know they've done wrong, we're setting an example. You know what I mean? Now, if I feel this is jeopardizing their soul before God, that puts it in a different category. But sometimes I think of children. You know, they strike back in some way. Now, I understand we have the discipline issue as well. But sometimes someone does something, I'm pretty sure it's intentional. They know I know it's intentional. Does it have to break the relationship? Or can I set an example of, Father, forgive them for they don't know what they do? Can I do that? I just think it's a powerful tool. And it goes against all that's in us as males to let something go, to not fix something right in the moment, to go ahead and take the sin, the consequence for the sin of someone else. That's a huge challenge. I am so sorry I don't have absolute answers for things. I just want to stretch your thinking a little bit about this. And I think the idea that there's wrong in lists and clear-cut forgiveness and all that, it's just not there. It's harder than that. It's more challenging than that. It requires more self-control than that. And I believe it even covers a case, not a case where a soul's in jeopardy, where they're losing control, the spiritual influencers are going down quickly, but a case where it's just a matter of restoring the relationship and setting an example, a personal example of temperance and not taking vengeance and all those things that we're kind of seeing we struggle with as males. Yeah, Brent? Yeah, thank you, yeah, yep, yeah. You already said, it's easy to be forbearing, but you don't really forget it. It's right there, it's off. It's actually in my weapon bag. I can pull it out when it's convenient, and it becomes yet another way of maybe exploiting that the sin of others. I'm tempted to talk about this a lot, but I'll just tell you in dealing with couples where there's been, I don't know if I should talk about that anyway. But let me just say this. If there's a situation where someone has obviously wronged another person, you might as well just tell them up front, the victim, if you want to call them a victim. I think that's maybe a little too simple. But You get to bear the consequences of this sin. That is not yours. You have the pain. That's what forgiving a debt is, isn't it? If I owe you something and you can, and I can't pay you and you forgive the debt, who's out the money? Isn't that what it is? It means I get to bear the pain. I get to suffer. I get to feel the heartache, right? And if I start pulling it out and pouring it back on you, that's not forgiving. I'm putting the debt back out on the table. Does that make sense? I think we got to see this, yeah. Sure.
With these
yes.
Things, it's not, I can call it whatever I'm, but I don't like, that's my personal thing.
Yeah, yeah.
My personal thing that I mean, I like you chewing gum and like that. You didn't break the God's law. You know,
yeah. Yep, I see that, but I'm hesitant to put a line that says if it's against God's law, because honestly, I don't know. So many of the ways we break God's law is my intent. What did I intend to do? I ask you not to, you did anyway. I think she did that just to make me mad. That's against God's law for sure. Well, I don't know that. And it could be a matter of immaturity or misunderstanding, or it could be even a moment of weakness that's not going to be indicating of character. Here's some suggestions about symptoms of a lack of forbearance. You probably don't believe this, but I actually took some other charts out. But anyway, keeping account, reviewing and remembering wrongs, and looking for things to add. That's kind of your point. I like a bag full of weapons I can pull out and pour back on people. That is not forbearance or forgiveness. Waiting for the other person to change as a precondition for my kindness. I'll say this with regard to the marriage relationship. One of the most harmful things I see as a result of worldly counseling is this introduction of the model of a contract into the marriage situation, right? He's annoying me. She's annoying him. You know, the only way we're going to work this out, we're going to sit around the table and we're going to write out a document. If you do this, then I'll do this. And if you don't do this, then what? Then I'm not going to do what's right. Wait a minute. That's not the deal. You see what I mean? It's a contract. This has to happen or else I don't have a responsibility. This person has not looked sorry enough for what they've done yet. And so I'm not going to treat them right until that happens. Y'all may have never heard of these kind of things before, but it's unfortunately very common. And so, anyway, that's the idea. So, remember, we're the leaders. Who's supposed to initiate this healing and to be the first one to ignore this as a strain to the relationship and to bear the pain of whatever the wrong is? Who is it? And, so where I thought he kind of was going, you know, there's always this giant trump card that you lay on any of these discussions, and somebody said it before, Father forgive. What is the giant trump card over every, this isn't fair, this is too hard, you don't know how bad she's been to me, all that. What's the giant trump card? Right, it's the cross. And does that ever come up in Scripture as an example of how we're supposed to treat one another? Yeah, like in Ephesians 5, which is, right where we are. Right, and so justifying my own sin, which might look like anger, insult, a lack of love, a withdrawal of fellowship, whatever it is, my own sin, unjustified, because I can say, well, they did this. It's the reverse of the contractual model. That is, if they break it, I break it too. Judging the entire character of a person by a specific sinful act, and that's what we like to do. We remember that time 4 years ago when she said this or that, and it really hurt, and it was in front of a bunch of people and all that kind of thing. That, of course, after 4 years, we know that was the sterling insight into her entire character, that one incident. You understand what I mean by that? Grumbling to others about my burden, especially when she may be aware of it. Avoiding or withdrawing from the person or situation because they've done to me. And women, as we talked about yesterday, their antennas are just longer, right? And so you think you're not really being as quiet and withdrawn as she kind of sees it. She knows that. that you're something's bothering you and you've withdrawn and you're kind of punishing her in some kind of an implicit way, and she knows, and it hurts more than you think it does when that when her desire is being waked up because of your actions. Anyway, these are examples of that kind of behavior. Okay, feeling superior because of the other person's shortcomings and because of the wrongs done to me. All right, I think this is a place where some of our male tendencies tend to show up in a negative way. Okay, so we covered romantic love last night. We probably should kind of open up our book a little bit and just talk about it somewhat. When I talk about romantic love, I don't just mean, in fact, I don't even primarily mean sexual desire. We talked about that a little last night. I see these things as, giant envelopes, with the most stable being pleasing God. And the next most stable on top of that to get that to happen is saving myself and saving someone else. And the next thing, the way that can be done, one way among many, many, including membership in a local church and devotion and study, and other, but among those would be good companionship, in particular marrying a good wife that will help me and her in the saving of our souls that will please God. Within that, there is romance, and that is this feeling, this magic kind of emotion that overwhelms us, and it ties us to another person, and it allows us to push through those forbearance situations that are difficult. If we'll just step back and remember, yesterday I felt pretty good toward her. And when we were first dating, I had a pretty good feeling. You know what I mean? That can carry us through, even though it's volatile, if it's deep enough and strong enough, that emotion can somehow carry us through when it's difficult to do things. And part of that romantic relationship is, of course, the physical relationship. One of the most strongest sensations that we have. And you know what? You can take that entire, iron base that goes all the way up to these very fragile, emotional, sensitive things. Do you know you can stand that on its head? Where my whole life is centered around what? One thing. These lusts. Whose God is their belly. Glory is their shame. Right? And whatever my sexual tendencies or orientations are, that's the identity in my life. And everything else is centered around fulfilling that. Do you see how that stands the whole thing on its head? As opposed to this other thing where the less stable, more powerful little dynamite packages that we like to put in a kind of a very, secure container and with all kind of shock mounts and other kind of padding and foam of security, it becomes the base for everything else. And how stable will our life be if that happens? I hope these pictures are helpful. Maybe they're not. I don't really know. So I'm talking about romantic love. And if you want to learn about it, I think some lessons are from the Song of Solomon. And if we had time, we'd kind of look at that. I take the two-character view, and I kind of centered around the wedding scene, which is in chapter 5 or 4. And in that, there's this description of the groom, whom she loves deeply, who is convincing her of his love for her. And convincing her to trust him and to allow a consummation of the marriage. And there's just many lessons from the book that we can look at. Here are some ideas. Just read the top-level thing. Romantic love exists. Start with that, men. Right? It's a real thing. It is an emotion. And I think the book of Song of Solomon is maybe God's way of saying to us, this is a real thing. It has boundaries. It's like all other desires. It has to be controlled according to God's plan. But it's a powerful and useful and God-given and beautiful thing that we need to understand. But it exists for marriage, not the other way around. We talked about that last night. The purpose of marriage is not just to create children or social stability or satisfy sexual desires. It's the other way around, right? It's meant to strengthen marriages. And when you flip that around, you destroy the marriage. That's what you do. Either whether before or after you're married, you're going to destroy the marriage or at least harm it in hard ways. It has to be developed between married couples. Romantic love seeks to possess the individual and not the sensation. If you look through the song, you'll find this phrase, I am my beloved and he is mine. It actually evolves. There's three times you find it and it slowly evolves to where the last one is, I am my beloved. The most important thing is now she is owned by him. And the early phase is he is mine, right? That's the kind of more important phrase of it. But it's not the sensation that's being described. It's this ownership of a person. You know what I mean? I imagine a group of guys. This is an illustration from C.S. Lewis. I have to give the credit. They say, let's go get some women. Right? You know what? You know, a bunch of guys are going out on the weekend. Let's go find some women. His point is this. The last thing they want is to get a woman. They want a sensation, right? They want a sexual experience. But the last thing they want is a woman that they own, that they have. You see what I'm saying with that? True romance, as God designed it, is aimed at the person, the whole person. It includes the physical attraction, but it's a larger dynamic than just that. And you see that in the song. She's not just attracted to his strength and so on, his body. He is attracted to her body as well, but it's way bigger than that. It has to do with the relationship. Third point, sexual attraction is the same as other physical appetites, right? We can talk about 1 Corinthians 6, it's a different sin in some way, but the point is this, it draws on us, it attracts us, and that's a good thing, but that's also a tool for Satan. So it's subject to God's laws. I go into a restaurant and I'm really hungry, and I pass by a steak on somebody's plate. I don't just reach over and grab the steak because I'm hungry. It's a natural desire, isn't it? God gave me that hunger desire. Why can't I just take that steak off somebody else's plate? But somehow we have in our heads that this desire is different from all others. It allows me to leave my wife and kids. It allows me to go do things that hurt other people deeply, that leave scars forever. But it's a natural desire, and I just fell in love with her, and I have these, and my wife's not giving me what I need or whatever. What are we thinking? We would never treat any other desire like that and try to, we would probably. We wouldn't justify it out loud like that, unfortunately. Okay, and the other thing about it is it is an emotion, and it has a physical aspect to it. Is it possible to change our emotions, or are they just kind of pre-programmed, and I am who I am, and I'm attracted to whom I'm attracted to, and I get angry over things that I get angry over? Is that the way emotions work? Can they be trained at all? Sure. I mean, think of it in a negative way. Are there things you felt guilty for early and then later, after a while, you stop feeling guilty for them? As an example. Yeah, Brent? Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Yep. Remember that when we get to discipline, because I think, yeah, and we train them out of that. We train ourselves out of that. And I think with regard to the emotional side of romance, you know, you do things that help that grow, or you do things that kill it. And you can treat someone in a way that will kill not only their emotion, but yours as well. Do you see that we train emotions by the thoughts, our logic, as well as our actions over time? We become inured to some things. We grow to like some things more than we ever knew before because we just do them and work at them and they have a higher priority. Is that not possible in romance? I think that's the picture. And yet, I can stop, I can hold off. That particular emotion doesn't force me to go sin. There's always a way of escape. I can control it in a physical way, but I can also mold it so it helps go in the right direction. You probably know this, but there's kind of a dynamic in marriage that there's the honeymoon. You ever look online, stages of marriage, you'll find about 5 or 6 different models, but they're all about the same. There's a honeymoon phase, you know. Then there's this kind of realism sets in. Then there's this toleration phase where we figured out, or that's the divorce phase. At about 7 years, you've just about had enough and you decide you made a bad choice, right? Because all these differences that were attractive at first, now they're just annoyances. Y'all know this is the way kind of it works. Peak divorce is right about 7 years. But if you make it through that with the right intent, those differences start to become strengths and complements, just like God had in mind. And the things that you're not good at, the things you can't see and your wife can, or vice versa. And the trust that's built and the emotion that binds them together, even when there's difficulty or differences, that grows and takes over. And now you have the synergy phase, or whatever it's called, you know, phase 4. I'm counseling one couple and I went through all that, you know, trying to keep them from divorcing 7 years from then. And that was a joke. So Emily just said, well, can't we just skip over the first 3 phases and go to the end? I suppose you can in a way, but I think it's forbearance and other things like that that allow that to happen. But developing the romance, that's not so much of a problem in the first year, but over time it needs to be nurtured, and that's kind of the idea. Interesting, in Song of Solomon, you get to chapter 8, you see more of a mature relationship between them, right? They have problems in the middle of the book. In fact, right after the marriage, he's done something, he kind of rejects her or something, you know, or she rejects him and then the other way. But they heal that. But later in the book, it's quite a mature relationship in chapter 8. Now they're thinking about others. I have a sister, she says, who's young. And what are we going to do to make sure that her marriage turns out as good as this one? At least that's why I interpret the psalm, but anyway, it matures. And it's not a god. Okay. Here, one more chart on romance from the Proverbs chapter 5. You know, there's quite a bit. I would say this, you probably know this. The Proverbs seems to be written to a young man to listen to advice and wisdom. We'll get more of Proverbs in the next module. I don't know if this is true or not, but when you look at the Song of Solomon, maybe you haven't studied, maybe you have, whose thoughts are we watching more in the Song of Solomon? The young man or the girl? I mean, or look at the wedding scene. You know, if I was making a movie of a wedding, where would the camera go, right? Where would the camera go? Right to the bride, right? Where's the camera in the Song of Solomon, the wedding scene? There's this soldier with, you know, strong men coming up, you know, in the kind of procession. And the thoughts and the heart, it's really more of the heart of the... You hear the voice of the groom, but you hear the thoughts. But the Proverbs seems like it turns that around, and it's more aimed at the men. And an interesting thing, Proverbs 31, we all know that's for the women to read. That's what they study in their women's Bible classes, Proverbs. Because what it says is, a worthy woman, who can be? Is that what it says? Who can find? Who is that really written to? So I think these advice in the Proverbs may be more for younger men. But what he says in chapter 5 about the marriage commitment, he says, drink water from your own cistern. We got to see some cisterns a few weeks ago. Running water from your own well. Should your streams overflow in the streets, your streams of water in the public squares, let them be yours alone, never to be shared with strangers. May your fountain be blessed. May you rejoice in the wife of your youth. A loving doe, a graceful deer, may her breast satisfy you always. May you be ever captivated by her love. Why be captivated by something by an adulteress? This, by the way, goes on to say what happens if that does. In terms of your life, your substance, your respect, everything just goes down and it's lost. But notice some things about this. First of all, it's kind of a private thing. It should be kept very private. Never to be shared with strangers. It's something, it's a secret. It's something that binds the two of you together. It's the thing that only you know. And I think it's not talked about with other men, and it's not talked about with other women for sure. Beyond that, it's plentiful. Your fountain is blessed. It's something that if the romance is nurtured, it's going to be a great, healthy, rich feeling and resource. And finally, it's pleasurable. I'm glad I know what's supposed to come up here. Pleasurable, right? And then finally, it's also permanent. It's something that captivates you. The language here, captivated by her love, is a little bit parallel to why be captured by an adulteress. You see, it's really the same word. And have you seen men whose lives, whose habits in life have really just got them bound? They cannot control them. You know what I mean? With regard to immorality or with regard to sexual sin. It's an addiction. We call it that nowadays, actually. In some way or another, it's an addiction. Wouldn't it be wonderful to be addicted to your wife in that way? That is, that's just a constant desire. It's a constant source of pleasure. You feel lost when you don't have that. And I don't just mean the sexual intercourse. I mean the relationship when she's gone. So we should be addicted in that way. So it should be permanent. And can you develop those things with some actions and attitudes? I believe that could be intentional. I think you can say out loud, it's not a trick or a secret. You say, look, we need to do some things to learn to be with each other more and to learn each other's nature and to be more and more dependent on each other. I worry about separate vacations. I worry about husbands and wives working in different places because they built worlds that neither of them knows about each other. I don't like the beaver cleaver model either, where Ward goes off every day and he doesn't come home till the afternoon and she has no idea where he's been or who he works with or his problems or anything. Maybe that's the only thing we can get to in this fallen world, but certainly let's don't have two different worlds and sets of anxiety that separate people even further. What can we do to bring ourselves closer together? men's night out and other kind of hobbies that draw us apart, to separate us. I don't see that as it working toward this romantic bind, this addiction to each other we should have. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, separate bank accounts. Yeah. Right. 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 And then we wonder, why are we not close together? You know, we don't even live in the same worlds. We don't wrestle with the same problems. So when you counsel people who've been unfaithful, you kind of look at their lives and you say, what do you mean you have separate bank? What do you mean you don't know each other's emails, passwords? What is this? You have no basis. So once that mistrust is started, you know, it's just going to grow because I can't see what you do. I don't know where you are. It's going to be more and more separate. This is, I think, extreme maybe in our technology-rich age and our kind of self-rights and privacy and all that kind of thing. I just think the Bible picture is, especially Song of Solomon, you ought to be together. Let's go together out to the countryside. Let's go stay in mom's house for a while. That's our vacation. That's what we do, is to renew our relationship, right? And I would just say standing in line in Disney World at separate sides of the park is not going on a vacation together. Think about where... that's enough, I think. Sure. I think rules like that, which are probably to some extent artificial, they're like boundaries. You can't make laws that God had. You could argue all that stuff, but man, take thought for things honorable in the sight of all men. Make no occasion to fulfill the lust of the flesh. And by the way, there's some point to work this in. I might as well work it in here. Let me explain something. When men are tempted to go and have sex with some other woman, is that mostly physical or is it emotional? And I understand there's an ego factor. Sometimes it's somebody who really appreciates you. But when you have that relationship, is it because have you now become a soulmate with that person? Is that typically the case? I don't think so. Maybe. Fortunately, I don't know from experience, but that's just in talking with people who've struggled with it. It could be this woman or that woman. Sometimes there's a lot of different women. It's not a soulmate situation. Now, maybe they tickled his ego, and that's the way the whole thing started. When women have an affair, more often than not, is it just like sexual attraction, or is there some deeper emotional involvement in that? Which do you think? We have to take a vote. How many think it's kind of the emotion comes first, and then, yeah, now on the man's side of that affair, probably the other way, but anyway. And so when a woman sees that you have gone and you have had some type of a sexual relationship with a woman, what's she thinking has happened in her mind? Is she just thinking, oh, his lust got a hold of him for the moment, just for the afternoon? Is that what she thinks happened? What does she think happened? Pardon? You don't love her anymore. You found a better person than she is. You now got a soulmate. Your heart is bound to this woman, you know. And we can almost laugh at that, knowing the way men are attracted sexually to other women. We just, like I said before, we're not out looking for a woman. That's the last thing. We're out looking for the experience, right? But to the woman, so back to your point, if I'm emotionally involved or someone takes her place as a companion of mine, I might as well be having the affair. Because in her mind, that's the heart of the relationship, much more than it is with us. You don't have to agree. I'm just telling you that from experience, I'm saying when you try to heal a relationship where there's been unfaithfulness, the thing with a woman is all about what he has done that's kind of like displacing her companionship, her the love, the romance and stuff. And I just look at the guy who's got his flesh is taking control of him. And I'm thinking, that's not the problem. There's other deeper problems perhaps, but that ain't it. It's something else. And I don't know how to fix that, but except say out loud things like that.
I gave my daughter was that careful because men, especially young college men, are like dogs. They're just looking for anybody to mate with. They're not serious about a relationship. So be careful what they entice you in.
Sure. Yeah, you've probably heard many times, you know, men will give love to get sex, right? Women will give sex to get love, and that's often the way it goes. But I think, you know, it's more than that, and I think, once again, this fallen world and male character gone to seed, if you know what that means, I mean, exploited by Satan. Yeah, it's an ego thing too, by the way, isn't it? Can you conquer this? Can you have this experience? You can brag about the buddies, you know, it's part of the, there's probably some of that too. And maybe she plays on that if she's a temptress. Like Proverbs 7, read that, right? That's how this happens. He gets his ego built up, but she's there with all the physical attractions, the smell, the touch, the look, the tone of voice, all those things. But she's also building his ego up too. So we're not talking about romance. We're talking about the opposite of that. Sorry, let's go back so we can tell our wives we talked about romance finally. We covered it, really. But just, I think we're making the point here. You got to work at it. You can't just watch and see if it works out or not. But you know what? If it doesn't work out, is the relationship built on that? Is the permanence of the relationship based on whether you're still in love or not? No. We said that's not the purpose. It's not the way you make the decision. This is intended to help the marriage be stronger. But if it isn't there, through illness, through exploitation, through whatever, through the sin of the partner, it does not change the command, what God has joined together, let not man put asunder. That's there. And it's not contingent on the emotion, the volatile emotion. I'll just tell you, they'll come and go. But we can work at it with our actions and our thoughts and other things to make that stronger. And it helps to know the character of women in this. You know, this is 1 Peter 3 again. Dwell with your wives according to knowledge. What is she like? I had a chart on the love languages, and I'll end up talking about it as long as if it were really up there. The interesting book, some ideas about that. But you better figure out what she thinks is expressions of love. It's probably not cutting the grass, even though to you, keeping the grass nice is kind of your way of showing that you love the family or something, right? It's probably not that, but it might be quality time. It might be words of affirmation. It might be acts of kindness when they're unnecessary, but they're pleasurable, those kind of things. You figure that out. You better figure it out, and you better work at it. As hard as you might work at doing a good job to advance in your career or some other worldly pursuit and getting clever at it. Okay, I spent a lot more time. So here's the assessment I hope you did. I put some highlights on these things. Let's talk about spirituality. Remember, what's the greatest commandment? Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. The second's likened to it. You love your neighbor. So that's spirituality and then this kind of selflessness. But what are some ways that I know where I stand? Do I pray often? Do I study the Bible on my own? Not because I'm teaching or going to. I initiate worship attendance for the family, including the special services and other meetings. I work to make sure the family's ready. I take that on as my, I'm an example, yellow I'm reading, of thinking and speaking the best of others, not judging motives prematurely, not gossiping, criticizing. These are things that are expressed, but they also reflect the abundance of the heart from which the mouth speaks. Sacrifice and service. I don't create a burden on my wife because of my unavailability. She doesn't know how to reach me. Something's wrong. I need to be reached, and I'm just not available. And there's no other number she can call for somebody that can go in the classified area and pull me out if there's an emergency. That is just not considerate. It's not her meeting her needs. Personal sloppiness, other self-centered activities. I'm known for volunteering for the weak and needy. My personal hobbies with the guys, if any, are subject to cancellation based on the desires and needs of my wife, and I'm not ashamed of that. I give up job opportunities and even income for family time and service to others. I'm visible serving at my child's school, clubs, and other activities. I've provided adequate life and health insurance at the sacrifice, maybe, of my own income. And the list is forever, right? How many ways can you think of where we can demonstrate with actions, with visible things, our attitude of sacrifice and service? And once those are in place, I think we better be working on our skills. the strength. Y'all know what I, have y'all figured out what I'm trying to say by that? That is the techniques. Well, I'm going to say tricks, but the way you do it. Are you pretty good at studying the Bible? Have you built up a whole bunch of things you've memorized? That's kind of a strength thing. You can have this selfless attitude, but not know quite how to do it. That's a start. But then the rest is these skills and strength. Are you the person in the family the Bible often the family often asks Bible questions like, "Hey, where's that verse?" or "What does the Bible say about?" And you know what? I'm able to answer that. Or give me a minute or two. I got to go get the concordance out, but I kind of know how to deal with that. And I'm the one they come to. It's not the mom. It'd be nice if she could do it too, of course. But I'm just saying that's. My physical condition is robust. I can easily accomplish required activities with energy and strength and to spare to care for others. I manage the expenses well within our income, including our liberal contributions, our long-term savings, short-term emergency funds. The debtor is this slave of the... I can't say it. What? Help me with that. What is it? Whoever owes money is a slave to the man he owes money to, okay? And you know what? If that amount of autonomy and freedom to make decisions and do what you need to do is taken from you, you're a slave to that extent with large debts and things that just control what you can do with your resources. I'm good at resolving conflicts between my wife and myself and between members of our immediate and extended family. Are you the one in the extended family that's kind of known as the peacemaker? Are you the one that nobody wants to come to Thanksgiving? You know? Yes. Yeah. 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 Same with me. I had no clue. Mary died. I probably spent months calling people saying, "I'm so sorry I'm late on this bill. I just didn't know how to pay it." Yeah. Yeah. That's true. That is really true, but at some point, the goals that we set, the strengths and those kind of things guide that activity. And I think there's a great measure of trust to say, I remember John Clark used to say, marriage is a thing of give and take, you know. He gives and she takes. But that was a joke. That was just a joke. Could we back up on the recording there? But the thing is, there's this, I think there's enormous trust to say, everything I have, even the little bit of cash you let me have, dear, You know all about it. You manage it. And here's our guidelines. And here's the way we work with that. And that unanimity of what our priorities are. What a wonderful thing. And it doesn't diminish your leadership. It's not a threat to who's in control or who gets to make the decision. That's your point. She's more skillful, maybe. And actually has more time, maybe. And has, you know, a better view of things. And so all of that. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. Right. Right. Sure. Yeah. 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 Wasn't what? Yeah. Wasn't it? I think Christ uses our abilities and our judgment to go and carry out the things he wishes us to do. It's not a threat at all. In fact, I've tried to say this last night. I'm not sure exactly. I think we think about being heads and so on as being the decision makers. It all has to come to us for sign off. I'm struggling to find that anywhere. I just don't think that's where. Look at these things we're talking about here. Is it that you're the decision maker? And we sometimes call the decision maker at work the bottleneck, right? That's where things get held up. Yes, thank you. Right. That's right. Sure. And, of course, trust and so on. We touched on this before, the very practical thing. I've seen it in couples that have struggled in moral ways, and I say, you know, I'm thinking, so the guy was able to go off, get a motel, pay for it, and she never knew that? How did that happen? Well, I know how it happened. They have totally separate financial accounts and different charge cards and different cell phone numbers, and they don't. I'm just telling you, you want to build some trust and community and communication, why don't you just have one a bank account, or at least have total visibility across all the accounts you have if you got retirement or other things like that. I don't know if I'm bothering you. I think the old guys are doing this, and the young guys are saying, what? What? That's what I'm seeing, by the way, up here. You know. Did I go check? I didn't even know how to check the bank account. Right. Yeah, exactly. Exactly right. And I think that extends to email accounts and phone numbers and messages. And because I'll tell you, that's the place where these affairs and so on are maintained nowadays. I don't know how people did it before. But now I'll just tell you how it's done. It's done by text messaging or by emails or some kind of social media as a kind of a private interchange. And it's amazing how people have been able to find each other after all these years or strike up a relationship and get deeply emotionally attached before there's even a physical relationship, and no one knows. In an older time, I think you'd have to at least kind of slip away to the motel out of town or something, you know what I mean, or meet at a restaurant or something, you know what I mean. Phones were kind of public and all that. Nowadays, it's way too easy. And that temptation ought to be, I think it ought to be, to a large extent, eliminated from our lives. Yeah. This is not where I thought we would go in romance. But,
my personal experience, when I've had to go out of town because of work or because of some family matters, what has, and that's when a lot of men take advantage.
Yes, travel's a huge problem. Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah.
My shift. A few times I was down in Dallas, guarding the fence line. When I get through with that, I go back to my my motel and I turn on the internet.
Yeah.
And I show my wife that I'm here, I'm having supper, I'm getting ready to go to bed. And we would have a prayer over the internet.
I was not good at that. I should have. My dad was. He worked for the phone company. He was proud of the fact that he could find a phone and make a call from anywhere in the world. So he was proud of the fact to say, when I ever traveled, I called home no matter where I was. And this was in 60s and 70s, right? Which you had to remember 14 credit card numbers and a PIN and some other things, you know, or else find an operator. Yeah, I think that's important. Travel's a huge danger. And I think that extra, like you were saying with regard to, you know, in a lunch together, travel could be way worse. Never travel, it seemed to me, with a woman alone, and certainly never exploit that privacy and unaccountability. So build some accountability into that. There are a lot of things that can be done if you decide that you'll do it. And you'll do it because of the first S, right? Because of your spirituality. But it becomes a skill to know how to do that and how to do it. All right. We're getting to children next. Children is next. Thanks. So I want to work on this. So if you don't remember anything else, you maybe learned where a verse or two is, where some of this information, at least the basis of it, can be found. Let's work through this. And you want to go to the first page in your book, you can take some of these notes and get these down. Where can I find that the reason for a man and wife to be called one flesh at marriage is found? What chapter of the Bible is the first or the explanation for why a marriage should be thought of as one flesh? Whatever that means. And I'm not sure that those people who read it in the time of the Israelites maybe understood. And I'm not sure we fully know today, but still, we know more. Thank you, Genesis 2. Where is one flesh quoted to prove that divorce is wrong? Thank you, Matthew 19 or Mark 10. Jesus contrasts Gentile greatness. We haven't covered that yet, but you might know where it is. It's very close to this previous passage. Jesus contrasts Gentile greatness with greatness in the kingdom. Yes, Matthew 20 and Mark 10. One flesh is quoted to prove that fornication is wrong. That's the second of the one flesh quotes, 1 Corinthians 6. The God, Christ, man, woman headship chain is described. Not unique to marriage. It has to do really with the, I'll give you a hint, head covering. Where would that be? 1 Corinthians 11. Women are to keep silent in the churches, and there's other commands or guidance for orderliness. The spirits are subject to the prophets, and if a visitor comes into your assembly and he sees a bunch of crazy things, he'll think God is a God of confusion. But if he sees order and worship, he'll fall down and acknowledge God's among you. Where would that be? Thank you. 1 Corinthians 14. Husbands will love their wives as Christ loved the church. One flesh is quoted to illustrate why a man will love himself, his wife as himself. Yes, yeah, same. Wives are being subjected to their husbands as the church is to Christ. Yep. Fathers, don't provoke or exasperate your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture. Ephesians 6. I want to make a little point there, because we've got this other issue that I want to keep coming back to. Maybe we'll close it, maybe we won't. But you know that there's this, kind of the qualities of character, typical doctrine, and then you get into the qualities of character, then you get into relationships, right? So husbands and wife, what comes after that is Ephesians 6, children, fathers and children, and so on, and then masters and slaves. Do you know what the next thing that comes after that is? What's the next discussion there in the latter part of chapter 6? Armor of God. Wait a minute. I thought we were talking about family relationships and implications with regard to sacrifice and service to others and so on. And now you're talking about being able to stand against the wiles of the devil. Are those related in some way? Yeah, and that's not the only place that kind of thing comes up, by the way. And I'm relating this, if you remember, to the fact that, you know, the men were soldiers and they had to have courage and they had to have the ability to fight the right things, you might say. Pretty close in context. Okay, husbands, not be bitter toward your wives. Thank you, Colossians 3. Fathers, not provoke or embitter your children to discouragement. Yes, I think it's Colossians 3 as well, but I might be wrong. It's right there. So that's kind of the parallel to Ephesians 5. Women are not to teach or have authority over a man. Yes, we looked at that. Two reasons given, one from before the fall and one from after the fall. Qualifications of elders and deacons listed. Thank you. First, younger widows commanded to marry and bear children. 1 Timothy 5. Qualifications of elders only, not deacons, are listed. Titus 1. Older women to teach younger women to love their husbands and children. That's good. Titus 2. The instructions there to younger men and older men. We looked at some of those qualities of character as part of our list last night. Wives are to submit to non-Christian husbands. A bit of a paraphrase. 1 Peter 3. 1 Corinthians 7 has things to say about that too. But I think 1 Peter 3 is those who obey not the word. Husbands are to dwell with their wives according to knowledge. Yes, same text. Grecian widow proto-deacons are selected. Acts 6 and qualifications given there. Consequences of the fall on men and women are stated. Yes, worthy woman described. You probably know that. We've had an interesting study the last few weeks on Job 31 instead of Proverbs 31. And that's where Job defends his integrity. And God kind of says, you know, he's kind of like the most righteous man on the earth. So it's probably a fair account of what men ought to be. So we've kind of looked through that as a study of qualities of character we should have. So that's maybe our version of Proverbs 31. The purpose of discipline is to drive out folly. Oh, we haven't gotten to that yet. It's Proverbs 22, and we'll cover that. God contrasts his work as the ideal shepherd. You haven't gotten to all those things. I think we've gotten to some of those. How about down there where men are to lift up holy hands without wrath and disputing? That's 1 Timothy 2, just before. And the rest we haven't covered, but you can see what they are. Hebrews 13, elders watch in behalf of our souls. The word elders often is used there, but still that seems what it's talking about. Believing men and women are told not to divorce because they might save their spouse. The 1 Corinthians 7, we had that before, right? So you know those. All right, how are we doing? I think it's time for maybe a stretch break. And I'm ready now to start Saturday morning studies. Anyway. So I want to start this with a discussion we've kind of been slowly having. I had it a little earlier than I intended to. But I think we approach the idea of fatherhood. I think we have to, especially, it seems like more and more, but I think I've just alarmed myself as if we are at war. Do you know, are any of you here survivalists, like have this private reserve out somewhere in Texas that, you know, where you got your stash and your weapons and your... Oh, that's right. That's right. It's a secret. Y'all do, but nobody knows where it is, right? Yeah. What's the point of that? Somebody in their mind, somebody in their mind thinks they're going to have to use that. Why? Yeah, something's going to go wrong with the world, right? And the whole world around us is going to kind of lose their mind, and it's going to be a threat to us. Isn't this true? I mean, I guess that's the idea. Why do you have all your food? You have your defenses, all that set up. Isn't that the idea that everything around is hostile, and that if I don't protect my family, nobody else is going to? There's no, other thing I can call. Y'all see what I'm getting at here? I would like to make, as terrible, stupid as an analogy it is, I'm not sure that's too far off from maybe the view we ought to have sometimes of our own families in this fallen world. Now, maybe I'm stepping out. This is too much of an assertion and too bizarre of an analogy, but let's look at just some verses. Just read them to you, okay? Read them with me. All who desire to live godly in Christ Jesus will suffer persecution. By the way, these aren't all the verses I could have put up here, right? But just a few. Just think about it. I beg you, as sojourners and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lusts which war against the soul. Have your conduct honorable among the Gentiles, that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may by your good works, which they observe, glorify God. Philippians 2. That you may become blameless and harmless, children of God without fault in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, among whom you shine as lights in the world. By the way, the survivalists, I'm not sure they shine as lights in the world, but still this whole idea of being different, way different, and therefore having some consequences. Inside of us, I delight in the law of God according to the inward man, but I see another law in my members warring against the law of my mind and bringing me into captivity to the law of sin in my members. All that's in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the pride of life, is not of the Father, but of the world. All that's in the world. What is the world? We know that we're of God. The whole world lies under the sway of the wicked one. Finally, we talked about this before. Right after that, all the family and relationship discussions, be strong in the Lord, in the strength of his might. Put on the whole armor of God. Build your survivalist kit, if you will, that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. For our wrestling is not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, powers, the world rulers of this darkness, against the spiritual host of wickedness in the heavenly places. Paul says in 2 Corinthians 10, in a context, it's a little bit, well, I won't go into that. But though we walk in the flesh, sorry, that typo, we do not war against according to the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not of the flesh, but mighty before God to the casting down of strongholds, casting down imaginations and every high thing exalted against the knowledge of God, and bringing every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ. I want to ask this question. You know, we talked about the role of men before, in the Old Testament, and that they were soldiers, and they were kings, and they were judges in the sense that judges were in the book of Judges, right, where they were deliverers. They actually came and carried out some judgment on the enemies of God's people with his help. Do some of these words stir you up to be that kind of a warrior? I mean, do you see that this might be the way that whatever God has put within men to be warriors, to fight for a just cause, to show courage, to take risks, right? To want to do the right thing, to be recognized for their courage and their valiant acts, right? In the face of danger and persecution and suffering. Where is that to be directed? Toward our wife when she annoys us? Toward our kids when they're stumbling and clumsy and all that? Is that where it's directed? Or is it directed toward the spiritual host of wickedness in the heavenly places? I think there's a place, if you want to be courageous and feel a sense of anger and take vengeance for harm that's been done against Satan and his forces for what they've done? Is this the place to do it? In fact, that passage, I think, in 1 Corinthians 10 goes on to say that Paul will take vengeance against the evildoers or something, or against sin or something like that. Some kind of an interesting phrase. Is this maybe a way to direct some of those male characteristics? And yet, is that what we do with them? You know what I mean? Oh, this is just the religious stuff. Oh, that's, yeah. I go to church. Yeah. We do that. We got that. Yeah. No. This is our warfare. This is the center of our life. This is where our courage is exercised. I'm saying the same things over and over again, so I'll stop saying that. So now nobody's nodding this way. Maybe you just go with me a little bit. Does this inform a little bit about how we might raise our children? What is the world that they are in? Is it hostile or friendly to spiritual values? Yeah, question. Yeah. Yeah, Jeremiah 35, yeah. Yeah. I think Jeremiah calls them in and says, you know what? You're Israelites. You don't even figure out how to follow your spiritual father, Jehovah. And these guys, they're doing harder things, more disciplined things. They don't drink. They don't dwell in houses. And they're not even Israelites. It's just because their dad said to do it, you know. But his idea was, look, maybe, I don't know, but we do this because it's a protection to us. I want us to be alarmed about this. And I think we should see rearing our children in this light, primarily. But I think what we tend to do is say, oh, they got to make a good living. You know, I'm going to be disciplined. Maybe that has a role in this warfare. If it does, do it. Go for it. But this is the heart of the issue. So given that, I'm not going to go over this chart because we went over it already. What's the purpose of family relationships for a Christian man, leader of a family? What's the purpose of his marriage, of his fatherhood of children? What is the purpose? Right. And there's other things, but seek first the kingdom. And these other things should be a part of that larger picture that are added automatically. Okay. Now, I just want to stop and say, okay, let's talk about the world for a minute. What is the world's picture? And I'll remind you of the Israelites leaving Egypt. No clue. Egypt had no clue. They had a bunch of made-up stories about how the world was created. Bizarre things, if you read Egyptian, you know, mythology and so on. I think we're in no better shape today, maybe worse. So here's kind of a foundation. First of all, no supernatural, there's only natural causes. People see the supernatural as something that's a crutch, probably imaginary. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't, doesn't matter. You can have it if you need it, right? That's kind of the idea. But it's nothing real that has an influence, it impinges on the natural world. Humans have evolved, that they're just animals in a different form, maybe more advanced. There's no eternal spirit. Religion is a product of that human intellect, which has evolved over time. It's not the result of some kind of intervention from the outside, supernatural. And finally, the goal of life is fulfillment, right? Eat, drink, and be merry. And that, because tomorrow you die. And Paul says that's probably valid thinking. If there is no resurrection, no supernatural, you might as well, that's the way we ought to live. And that's kind of the way the world organizes its thinking. So these are the four ideas. No supernatural, evolved humans are just animals in a higher form. Religion is man-made, and the purpose of life then in that kind of a vacuum of any other larger value is just get what you can out of life. That's all there is. Be happy, be fulfilled, something like that. The more realistic thinkers know that this leads to just absurdity and despair. If you read the philosophers, they don't necessarily live consistent with that philosophy, but that's kind of what they conclude, which is right. I think it's a correct assessment. But anyway, that's where we are. So with regard to rearing children, you can kind of put some of these ideas together. And what you have is, since there's no supernatural accountability, commands, whatever, and we're really just animals that follow our instincts, our genes, our environmental influences, the chemistry that are in our bodies, our natural, totally natural bodies, there's really no intrinsic right or wrong. And since we're animals and we've evolved to the point where we have religion that's more or less man-made, it's silly to think about sin as anything anyway, but certainly no spiritual consequences for sin. Now, you see, I'm getting to the rearing of children here. Would this worldview inform the way people might think you should rear children? I was taught to say rear and not raise. I'm sorry about that. Randy, is that right? Thank you. For Randy's sake, I'll keep saying rear, unless I forget. So religion is for man, and purpose is fulfillment. And so that just means I just got to make the choices that are best for me, right? I can't get this out of my head. It's going to come out. I'm not smart enough to think ahead fast enough. If I think I'm a girl as a two-year-old, I am a girl. Who knows better than me, by the way? Yeah. Who knows better than me? Or 5 or 55. And so I just have to make the choices for myself. And who are you to say they're wrong? You have no authority bigger than that. Would this affect the way we train children and the things we might discipline them for and help them with? There's no right or wrong and there's no consequences. Then why do you as a parent have any right to make moral choices or to constrain your child with regard to moral choices in any way? Yeah. Yeah. I think that's what the T stands for in that EIEIO, you know, LGBTEIO thing. But right. So isn't toddler? There's already a T size. Maybe there's a T style now. I don't mean to make fun of this, but please don't get focused in on that one bizarre example that's right in the news in our face right now. But that's an extreme case. But there are other cases too, right? If I need to express my anger and that's the way I am in my, you know, or if I need to do this other thing and I don't like doing this other thing that's hard for me to do, who knows better than me what's right and best for me? Because I'm born that way, just like the puppy dog has certain instincts that he follows. And if there are no spiritual consequences for sin and I've got to make the best choice myself, the child has just got to find his own way. And now we're starting to think about some of the Proverbs, right? The child left to himself comes to mind. Yes, Brent. Yeah. Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, right. And I'm trying to combine this idea that we are influenced by this worldview that's pervasive. It's in the education system. It's in the literature. It's in the counseling. It's in the social workers. We'll look at a little quote from the Pediatric Society. But combine that with this idea of a war, a world in which everybody's hostile. And I think this is the hostility. This is the ideological conflict that we're wrestling with. Now, if I haven't gotten to where, so therefore you got to smash your kids every day and, you know, keep the belt handy. I'm not getting to that. I'm just saying, let's start with this idea that we are living in a world that's hostile to spiritual values. And some of the things we have to do have to address those. And it has to be pretty diligent. And betimes is the old King James, discipline him. It has to be continual and constant, and watchfulness is required. So here are the principles of modern parenting, my opinion. Happiness and fulfillment is the primary value. You can ask experts, you can try to figure it out yourself, but you know, if somebody gives me advice, it's going to be filtered through whether I think that's a good advice or not. I won't take some advice that I don't think makes sense, like as if it were from God or something, right? If I don't think it makes, you know, that's where we live our life mostly anyway. Somebody says, you know, I don't think that's what the Bible, you know what, that doesn't make sense to me, and so I don't follow that. I'm looking at the experts, and even they have to be filtered through whether I like it or not. It's interesting, I read these kind of self-help things, and they're really basically trying to appeal to this, you already know this anyway, here's an example from your life that makes this true, because there's no higher authority to appeal to. Others have to treat you right, first, before you are required to treat them in the proper way. Strive for balance. Don't go to extremes in religion and other things. Don't be a fanatic, you know, have a little bit of this hobby and a little bit of that interest and, you know, be good at everything. Some things are just too hard to do, by the way. They're just too hard. Just because that's the way I am. They're just too hard. There's no temptation taking you. So that's a problem. Okay, so anyway, I think that's kind of the principle of modern parenting. Don't push them too hard. You'll push them over the edge. Too hard to do, and so on. So here's some teaching on fatherhood. I think you know all these passages. We looked at the one in Ephesians 6, do not provoke your children to wrath. And we could talk about what that means. I think it means that you are consistent and loving in whatever you do. And we can talk about that. One of the dilemmas that we actually talked about this week in our class, that I've thought about it, and fortunately Daniel's here, so I can't make any claims. I don't see a reason to yell at your kids ever. I did not say I never did. I'm just saying, think about what you're showing with that. Do you need to yell? Do you need to show temper? That's what I mean by that. And you might, well, they need to get emphasis. Okay, are there better ways to show that? Are we teaching them to yell and lose temper when things are not going the way they think? Are they clever enough to know, oh, this is a special circumstance? Just as an example, but you want to make a kid angry, you be angry at him. Or you be angry one day and not the next in an inconsistent, unpredictable way. And you don't know what to expect. And that's frustrating. And maybe that's what Colossians is talking about, which when they'll be discouraged, disheartened, another translation. Hebrews 12 we'll look at later, and that is, I am thinking hard, as I know best, is the Hebrew writer saying. That earthly fathers do the best they can. God knows better, of course, but that's what their role is for their real children. And it's out of love, and it's aimed at their purification and holiness. Timely, or betimes, or consistent, or however you want to translate Proverbs 13, that's an expression of love. May not necessarily be the rod, but it is very timely attention. And by the way, these are aimed at whom? Moms. They're there all day. They have to take care of this. Who is this? Who is this for? I think it's fathers. I mean, not like parents even. That'd be nice if you could say, well, yeah, between us, we'll get it done. Give instruction, train for later years, and in 22:6 in the way he would go. Devout, just, blameless, and so on. Paul gives this example. He actually uses both a mother and a father in that chapter in 1 Thessalonians to describe his behavior among them. But things he says about a father, I exhorted, I comforted, I charged each one of you. These are the things that he did and said, this is my role as a father toward you. So here's some things, and I won't go through this. I think these may be listed in the book. I'm not sure. Some things that are God's pattern of fathers. So these are not direct commands to fathers, but it says, you know what? If he who called you is holy, be ye yourselves also holy. Well, let's imitate God's pattern of fatherhood as well, because that's where we learn about perfection. These are in three groups, you can probably tell. Perfect, holy. He himself tempts no one, James 1. There's no unrighteousness with him. There's no variation or shadow cast by turning. He's daily consistent. He's always true, even if every man's a liar. There's never a lie or vacillation. He's good, and he's also severe, meaning just and kind. You can count him to be just the right kind of justice, fair in our treatment, but also with kindness. He judges without partiality. I think that's an inherent righteousness, and I think that's equivalent to our spiritual side. These are the three S's, if you haven't figured that out. So these are the S's that are there. But as far as his care, his sacrificial, Romans 8, who can be against us if he's for us? He gives needed gifts, right? Every good gift and every perfect gift comes from God. He leads, he protects from stumbling, he chastens for our profit, he bears us through trouble. He has unconditional blessings given for both those who deserve it at the moment and do not deserve it at the moment, Matthew 5. Y'all see where I am, I'm up here. Pure, peaceable. The wisdom that comes from above, that's, I think, informed by God's nature, easy to be entreated. He pities, he's merciful, he draws unfaithfulness with love. He's a source of mercy and comfort. He's a comfort and hope. He loves enough to adopt and call us children, even though we're unworthy. Send his son on our behalf in a sacrificial way. He loved us while we were yet enemies. Does this characterize our character toward our children? Or are they just sometimes just too inconvenient? They make us angry, and they're not going to get this kind of care. And finally, God is able, strong. He's aware. He's all-knowing. He has deep wisdom and knowledge about who we are. He knows our inner parts. He saw us when we were being formed. He knows everything about our nature. He can do all things exceedingly abundantly above what we ask or think. This isn't us, but it's not a bad pattern to think about. Are there analogies to these, the three S's, intrinsic qualities, our spiritual nature, our sacrifice and service, thinking of somebody else first, and finally our abilities. Can you see some of that? I mean, just a simple example. You guys omniscient, you know what all your kids are thinking the moment they think it. You can read their minds, all that. Of course not. But can you get better at that? To knowing what's going on? To know what bothers them, know what gives them joy, to know what they're good at, to know what they're not good at, to know what insecurities and fears they have that need to be comforted. This is the same thing. I think we work toward having that. Can I give them everything they need? Unfortunately not, but I can work on that too. I can see what their shortfalls are and their insecurities, and I figure out how to, even if I have to sacrifice my time or money or something like that. I just think this is a huge challenge of a pattern that God gives us. In our holiness, our purity, we tempt no man. We're not a source of evil. We're nothing but good gifts, right? And then this sacrificial interest of others first, and finally our abilities that we can build on in our awareness and in our actions. So just a challenging pattern. I think I have a questionnaire in there that relates to that. And I'm sorry these are so busy charts, but I've tried to make some kind of a questionnaire that makes it practical. So you might want to check these out. Once again, we're in the not all the way to always. Not at all the way to always. Only a little, some. Are you wholly righteous within your family as a father? You're never an influence for evil in your child's life. In terms of your own example of temper, self-control, your own priorities, the entertainment you bring in, other things like that. What do you think? Are you truthful and honest? A child never would see an inconsistency or a hypocritical element in your character. I'm sorry, I keep wanting not to say things, but I'll tell you, one of the things that bothers women, but I think it's now, I think it bothers kids too. They see their dad at church, and he's leading a prayer, or he's serving the Lord's Supper, and they know something about him. And it just eats them alive. I think it's a cancer in their hearts. And one of the things I often tell the men, do not participate, if they're struggling with something and their wife knows, do not participate in public worship. Now, maybe that's terrible advice, but it's not for his sake, it's for her sake, or the kid's sake. Do y'all see that? God has no variation, neither shadow that's cast by turning. Can we live that way and be seen that way? Or do we show one thing at home in private and then we show up at the church building and we look a different way? That hurts people. I think that's cruel. We're fair and impartial. We're sound in our judgment of character. What do you think? We're intolerant of evil. And whenever we punish, our only goal is for the good of the child. We'll talk about that. We're smart, observant, wise. This is our analogy to God who knows all and is all that. But we actually work at it. We ask questions. We watch the child. We think about it. I think that's the secret of parenting, by the way, from the parent's point of view, is when the mom and dad work together and they're always experimenting, always learning, always talking to each other, always thinking it through, always trying to build a better model of how this kid responds. You know what I mean? It's not that you spank in just this angle or get the right size rod to use. It's this constant awareness, and it grows out of love. It's a constant job. And every minute is, and you know what? Each child is not the same. And so you got a new science experiment on your hands, and you got to go figure it out and constant work in the work of it. So the way to show that is to go to the child and say, look, I have really messed up, and I'm doing the best I can. And I actually often, now every time, I will ask a woman who's struggling with something like that, I will say, does it bother you when he leads a prayer? And if she says yes, I go to him, different meeting, and I say, I think it would be good if you didn't lead prayers for a while. And it's not because I think he shouldn't, it's just I think for her benefit, just to help her feel better and understand, don't be rubbing that sore. I don't know. This may be bad advice. I'm just trying to give you a practical example of how hypocrisy can rise up and hurt people's mentality. there's an example of something that needs to be worked out, you know, as a priority over our worship, our sacrifice. Okay, keep answering questions. Provides for all needs, gives gifts, including time, which is harder than gifts, by the way. I mean, like, literal toys and things, when it's needed. Leads, protects, provides strength through troubles, pities, shows mercy, kindness, and patience. Of course, remember, the macho model is we do not value people who are weak, who cry easily, who are hurt, and then they can't get over it, you know. But this is a model that we need to kind of think through for kids, especially if, I guess, daughters. I didn't have to deal with that, but I think it may be a special challenge. Love sacrificially, even when undeserved, and we'll talk about it in this one. Powerful, competent, energetic, effective, respected, successful, all of that. And that's how we're perceived. Not perfect, but... And then down here, does not provoke to anger or discouragement, teaches God's word. I have no idea why that's not capital. Explains meanings in the world, provides practical wisdom and knowledge about this world. Oh, great. That's good. What you might do here is just pick three where your answers are a little bit far too far to the left and write them down below and say, what can I do? Take an action and act yourself into doing better in this area. And that may be learning more. And so what you're going to do is you're going to have a daddy time every Tuesday night for an hour, and we're going to just talk about stuff. And it'll be weird at first, but we'll keep doing it till it's just part of our habit. Yeah, Brent? Yeah. She should know better. Yeah, right. I do think there's a difference. We're going to talk about that. I don't think you would ever see the kind of punishments that we're talking about coming up would ever be appropriate toward a wife. I mean, that's just not the way it is. I think forbearance takes over if there's some wrong done. I'm going to stop making those kind of comments anymore. But counseling becomes difficult, and you finally just have to say, you know what, you cannot control this other person. I'm going to say it anyway, I guess. You do the right thing. And in fact, if you can erase any expectation that when you do the right thing, it's going to have any beneficial result and do it because it's right. This is the husband-wife situation, right? This will not work with kids, I don't think, because they're not mature yet. And it may not work, but it's just the right thing to do. But with kids, I think you have more responsibility than that, because you are in the place of actually creating negative consequences. And earlier, way earlier in their life, better. You know, of course, that's when that happens. We'll get to that. So I'm going to skip over this, but I do think this is so important. This is a tricky list. If you go down through here and imagine your kid has grown up, if you have children. I mean, if you don't, imagine you have some and they grow up and they're 30, 35. They've got a family of their own. Maybe they have a house, maybe they don't. They're working, we hope. Maybe they're not, whatever. What is important to you about that child living now in the world that you've launched them into? 35 years. Can you picture that situation? So answer all these questions there down the left. And just so you'll know the trickiness here, you fill in the answer in that white square, all right? Well, the columns there represent different kinds of values, priorities, right? Spiritual, a good family, good social environment, intellectual strength, physical health, financial health, and then fun things. Things you have, things you do that are fun. Now, I don't normally reveal that till you've gone through that list. But do you see the challenge sometimes? We picture where we want our kids to be. What's the most important thing? Right? They've already got a house by the time they're 35. If they haven't, they've been a financial failure. They're in a good career. They like what they do. They've got a lot of friends, right? They got a lot of healthy grandkids running around, for my benefit, of course. right? Or something. And I get these priorities set, and then, wait a minute. What is the battle we're in again? What's the world we're living? What's the struggle we're involved in? Is it to get kids to have good careers? Is that our challenge? So I'm telling you to think about these priorities. But I do want to cover this in a little detail, too. Do kids learn about priorities from us? About what's the most important? Where's the first place they're going to see it? They're going to see it in us, right? What will we do? I hope that's coming up next. What indicates our priorities? Here are some thoughts about it. By the way, they're watching us. And they're watching us not with the best wisdom that we might wish they would have. Now, we can think, you know, I'm missing one service. It's a class. I'm not getting much out of that class. Actually, I think this is a better priority for our family because it'll be good time together. And, you know, kids are not that subtle, I don't think. They kind of see things in a much probably more black and white, simple way. We set some priorities about what we do, and maybe in a more overt sense. Where are we investing our time and effort? What do they see in our lives? What do we talk about? Especially when we're with other Christians, what do we talk about? The kids ever listen in? I think so. I did. Maybe today they're all tied up in other games and things, but I think I listened. Preparation and provision for high priority items. What is it that's important? What am I saving for? What am I using my vacation days for? The failures in my life that make me worried or make me angry. What is it that causes anxiety? Are they spiritual issues? Are they issues with the church or with weak Christians? The choices when priorities are in conflict. Which way do I go? An eagerness and anticipation versus a dread and drudgery towards spiritual activities. Yeah, it's time. We got to get the sacrifices made and how easily I'm able to give something up. So for kids, you know, there's always what we tell them, right? But what is it they really see is what we're doing. I think they're watching, and that's really the story. Okay, let's talk about, so here are some ways we teach priorities. Very practical things. Once again, I think kids are, usually they're more literal the younger they are. They see things in a very literal way, and they're going to take the messages as if they were, explicitly, literally stated. How much are the academic goals in your child's life, how do they compare to Bible knowledge goals? We don't give grades down here at the Sunday school, right? So for some reason, maybe it's something worse than that, but we don't have much emphasis on that. But boy, they make a C in math, that might keep them out of a good college. You know, that's serious. That's serious stuff. Diligence for Bible study and devotion versus homework, piano practice, baseball, TV time, whatever. You see that they will soak up that implicit priority in a praise or criticism for their performance in sports versus their moral behavior, their politeness, respect for older people, their personal purity, their integrity when it was tough to tell the truth, or their Bible knowledge or their demonstrated character, their stylishness versus their modesty in dress. What do we teach in our priorities there? Our emphasis on sleep for school versus Sunday morning Bible study, being able to be there. You know, he was out really late, and we had all the soccer team over, and they all stayed up late. We just weren't in any shape to get down there for Bible study or other things. Yeah, I'm not going to rant here. But what do we talk about? A quantity while we are in the way. I'm quoting from Deuteronomy, you know, when you talk about God's law. What do we praise? What is our Sunday lunch conversation about? Is it related? You may ask, you may know what the lesson was about and talk about that. And then we critique the preacher, right? Then as we have roast preacher and something else. Yeah. What is the reading material and other media in our home? Including our collection of movies and so on. Who are our heroes? Who are the family heroes that we talk about, that we all know and study and collect their cards and whatever? These are things that teach priorities. There's more. What are we excited about? What are our vacations planned around? How hard is it for them to get together with other Christians, or how often do we do that? What sacrifices do they know we've made, financially or otherwise? What effort do we have is setting habits to get to worship? What's an insistence on their participation in the big social events at school or wherever versus their participation in spiritual activities? Advice about choosing career What kind of advice do we give them? Is it all centered around, you know, there's a big demand, you can easily get a job, you have great job security, you know, housing prices are low in this area. Are those the ways we make our decisions? Is that what we're teaching them to decide? Implicitly now, I'm not saying we would say, no, ignore the fact there's no church in the whole state. We don't say that out loud, but we're saying, hey, you know, the man's got to make a living. Think about a career and a, you know. Are we most insecure about our loss of job or loss of health or about our loss of faith or the family's loss of faith? These are things we're teaching by example. All right. I'm going to do one more home stretch, purpose of discipline. So 30 more minutes and we'll get there. Because I think we were saying and agreeing that the father has the primary responsibility for this discipline. I think we said that before. And that doesn't mean necessarily that he does it the most often or the most number of minutes, but I think that's a primary role and maybe sets the guidance and the policies maybe under which that discipline is done. I don't know. You kind of work through that. You're not there all day. That's probably not the best thing. We're in a fallen world. Your wife is. She deals with it. It seems like when you're there, boy, what an opportunity to learn and to set the precedent about the mechanics of how the discipline, negative discipline, I'm primarily talking about now, is done. But to talk about that, I think we've covered that. That's the fathers have that responsibility. To talk about that, I'm going to skip over these. We've talked about Hebrews 12 enough. I want to go to the Proverbs for a minute. And this maybe won't make sense, but there's a reason I want to do this. And I want to ask you about the Proverbs. Proverbs, as you probably know, contrasts the fool and the wise man, right? Isn't that right? What is wise? What does it mean to be wise? I'll tell you an answer that I often hear. I would say, well, knowledge is when you know a bunch of things. Wisdom is when you know how to apply it. You put all that together and now you're wise. You know what that implies is that unless you've learned a lot, lived a while, you can't be wise. Doesn't it? I mean, where do we think the wise men are? I mean, one kind of picture is you go to the mountain. They're up there doing this. And you ask them the hard question, like, is this bird alive or dead? You know that, you ever heard that story? And the man says, because you know what's going to happen. The bird's alive, but if he says it's alive, you squeeze it. And if it's not, you remember that tricky question? He says, it depends on you. You know, and you go, whoa, that's wise. Strong answers, deep knowledge, right? Hugely abstracted principles about how the world operates. That's wisdom. Isn't that what it is? I want to assert to you that I don't really think that's what wisdom is in the Proverbs. And there's a contrast between two ways of living, a fool and a wise man. I'm going to show you some of the verses. And remember that who was Proverbs written primarily to and for? An old man? A young man. And he's told to be wise. And now there's pictures of what it means to be wise. And look at these verses and see if you see. So I think you can think of wisdom. It probably is presented this way because you can buy it as gold. It's presented as a commodity that you can get more of. I think that's true. But I think it's more presented as character. This will be my assertion, and we'll try to look at some verses. It's a way of living. It's a character that I adopt that is the way in which I interact with the world. So let's look at some of these pictures of a fool in the Proverbs. This will make some sense later, maybe it won't, but the wise in heart accepts commands, but a chattering fool comes to ruin. What's the character there that you see in a wise man? He listens and obeys. He's actually willing to submit, whereas the fool, he just talks, right? In fact, I think that chattering may have, there be made this idea of, a, you know, when you, when I do this, I can't hear anything, so I don't have to, that may be the concept behind that. A fool spurns parents' discipline, but he who heeds correction shows prudence, right? What's a fool and a wise man here? What's the idea here? I come to you with correction and I reject it. It makes me angry or something, or I accept it. Now, does that have to do with the commodity or just the character? Right, that's just how you... A fool finds no pleasure in understanding, but he does delight in airing his opinion, right? He's a talker. He's not a listener. In fact, so we think about the wise man. We're always thinking of the wise man as the one who has all the answers, and he says wise things. What does this proverb actually say the wise man does? Is he saying wise things or what? I'm sorry, I've gone ahead here. He's understanding wise things, not saying things all the time. He's less of a talker and more of a listener. That's really what wisdom is in the Proverbs. You'll see that in others too. The fear of the Lord is the beginning, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. They're not listeners. The way of the fool seems right to them. Who's the smartest man in the room? It's the fool, right? And he's like the best listener in the room. He's the one who needs and accepts the advice. Could a young man have these characteristics and be wise by this definition? Of course he could. Without knowing very much, he could have these qualities of character, right? Those who trust in themselves are fools, but those who walk in wisdom are... What's the fool's view of his own capability? Yeah, he trusts in himself. I'm the most trustworthy person around. Trusting anything else is probably, to him, is not desirable. Some more things. No pleasure in understanding, but delights in airing the opinion. I think that's a repeat from before. He gathers crops. The wise man is a prudent son, gathers crops in the summer, but who sleeps in the harvest is... What's the character quality that's represented there? Yeah, and diligence, and yeah, that's right. Self-control to get up and get something done and use time wisely and so on. A sluggard says there's a lion in the road. So I'm going to 14. A sluggard turns on his bed like a door on its hinges. I'm not sure the exact imagery there. It could be that there's some motion, but the door doesn't ever go anywhere because it's attached to the bed, right? Or it could just be this picture of the guy that he's just sleeping. And, you know, the only motion you see is just related to his tossing and turning in the bed. On the other hand, he's too lazy to bring the food to his mouth. He starts a job, doesn't finish it. He's wiser in his own eyes than seven people who answer discreetly. A fool detests turning from evil. So I don't like to be corrected, and I don't like to change what I'm doing. I'm trying to get to... Y'all have too many devices going in here. That's what Jeff was telling me. There's too much... Anyway, a fool says in his heart, there's no God. And the reason for that is he cuts off any influence that he would be accountable for, I think, among other things. All right, do you see where I'm going with this? I want you to think about small children with regard to some of the characteristics that we've been talking about, right? I'll put these up here. Skip on to this one here. A child can be wise or foolish. Does this describe small children in a way, if you think about it? They don't like to be restrained or told what to do. I'm talking about small children. You know what I mean? The two-year-olds. And you say, you can't go there. Or you can't play here. You can't have that candy that's right down there where they'll see it in the grocery store. And, you know, they just, they don't like reproof. They don't change. They don't listen. Will not learn. They like to hear themselves talk. They trust in their own opinion. Now, I'm not asserting that they're evil people somehow or another born in sin, but isn't this characteristic more of small children who have not been taught that character of wisdom? They're born in a way just to scream out for their own selfish needs, right? They're hungry or they're wet or they're cold. And slowly over time, that self-centeredness, that talking and not listening, that not wanting to be constrained of anything I'm kind of compelled or impelled to do by my desires, that's kind of get trained out of them somehow. So look at these characters. He likes to hear himself talk. They're short-sighted. Boy, kids, I mean, I don't want to take my coat out, you know. It's too much trouble. You know, and like 5 seconds later, you're out the door and it's freezing cold, you know. But just hard to see that far ahead. Avoids work. May be attracted to sin. I saw something the other day. It was something to do with... I think I was just a comedian or something. And he was talking about hitting your kids. And he said... People say don't hit your kids because, no, that was in a sermon. I'm sorry, take it back. Don't hit your kids because you'll teach them to hit each other. And he said, they already know how to hit each other. I'm not teaching them anything they don't already know. And that's kind of true. They know to grab stuff that's not theirs. They need to be taught not to do that. and that's kind of, I thought that was a pretty good way illustrated. And maybe denies spiritual realities. That's what a fool is. So with regard to children, I think this forms a little bit of a guideline for what ought to be punishable offenses. And I'll show you why in just a minute. I think I see in this list rebellion or disobedience. And by that I mean that you see a child who has done something. Well, easy example, I always use it. You know the high chair tray. a perfect little like billiard table, especially with English peas. They roll around, and it's good for them to learn how to manipulate and all that. And a lot of times kids will test the law of gravity. They just, yep. Happened again. Now that's inconvenient for mom. Is that rebellion? Okay, stop. You're going to say it depends a lot here. Is this rebellion? Why does the child look up like that? There's a rule, right? We've already talked about this. We got the little hand slap last time. But I don't know for sure. I'm testing a different law. It's not the law of gravity. It's the law of mom or dad. I know what happened to the pea. That's not the issue. I'm wanting to know, is the world still the same as it was a few minutes ago? And then company arrives. I'm testing the law still, right? You see what I'm saying? Or I'm in the grocery store. Where I wonder if things work the same way in the church building as they do it. Do you see what's happening here? And so you really are starting to see this exploration of the space of where my will can go beyond this external law that I have. Is that foolishness? I think it's getting there, right? And you see the difference there. Now, you spill the milk for the third time at supper, and I'm totally annoyed by that, and I feel like wearing you out. But is that really the question of how what an inconvenience you have created in my life? Is that really the question? Is that rebellion or stubbornness? Thank you. And what does it depend on? Well, do we have a rule about that, about setting the glass too near the table or doing something or getting up from you? Or it just happened three times because they're clumsy two-year-olds. I think this is helpful guidance to know, what am I addressing in this discipline? I'll get to this more. Disrespect, stubbornness. I see these in the list. Self-centeredness, selfishness, laziness, carelessness, obvious evil, temper and cruelty, dishonesty, profanity, and immorality, those kind of things. If I'm hurting someone, hitting someone, stealing, not telling the truth, those are in the category of disregarding God's law for whatever reason. It seemed like that's the real... Now, often Proverbs 22, I think it's verse 6, is it? Where it's trained up in the child in the way he should go in the old. That's the verse we always start with. I think this is the right verse to start with right here. Look at this verse. Because I don't know what the way he should go is. That verse just confuses me. If I knew the way he should go, I'd be in business. But I just have to read the rest of the book to figure that out, right? But here, I also have to know what folly is to understand this one. But this is four different translations. They're all slightly different. Folly is bound up in the heart of a child. Do you see that now with this definition of wisdom and folly? It's not that he's stupid. He steps on the rake and it bops him in the head. That's not folly. Folly is stubbornness and rebellion and talking when you should be listening and objecting, chafing at rules in any way, right? Doing cruel things, knowing that they're wrong to do. Disrespecting authority. That's folly. Now, I don't think a child knows what is wrong yet at some point in their life. As a baby, they surely don't. So how do they learn that in a fallen world? How are they going to learn that after a while, knocking peas off the tray is just not right? For whatever reason. Well, they have to have a rule that defines that. Now you can move it into the area of folly or disrespect or disobedience. But I think often we're tempted to discipline because it's been an inconvenience to us or because I've been embarrassed in front of all my friends or because I need to demonstrate that I'm a strict parent, right? And this terrible thing has happened, but I never made a rule. It's just it embarrassed me real bad or made me clean up milk or something like that. So you got to move it. Anyway, foolishness is bound up. The Holman Bible says it's tangled up in the heart of a youth. It requires some extraction, some thinking about how to remove that folly as character from a child. I believe the Proverbs writer is saying to us that in this fallen world, there are some things we've got to train out of a child that are naturally there. As opposed to what we saw earlier in that worldview that says, hey, it's natural. They have to experiment. They have to experiment with yelling and hitting and disrespecting and disobeying. Right, they have to experiment with that and find their own way in the world. We wouldn't want their minds to be twisted in some way to think that they need to be restricted or respectful or self-controlled or listeners and quiet sometimes. That would be a worldview that, the opposite of this. So the motive is that his life will be better. And it seemed to me that this rod thing works has to be worked way early, at the very first signs of tests of will, of rebellion. And it is about the English peas on the tray. Otherwise, it's going to be about taking the car without permission or drinking when that's a family rule. You know what I mean? It's going to get to that point. Start early with this idea of what wisdom really is. And that is you listen and you obey. And it's not inconsistent. It's one time. We have a rule. This is what happens. And if that's done really, really early, it seems like it's easier as you go forward. Not always, but that's when it should be done. Yeah, so I think the rod is not the last resort. It maybe has to be the first resort when verbal appeals are not yet effective. They're not, but then later combined. All right, I'm going to keep on going and try to get to. So create a pattern for the future. It's in the child's best interest. It has a spiritual benefit. Okay, let's do some test cases. Is this folly or not? All right. 2-year-old refuses to come at parents' request. Thank you. And what does it depend on, really? What does it depend on? They're in the middle of the freeway, and I'm saying, come, come. What does it depend on? Have I set a rule? Do we have a rule about when daddy says come or whatever? That happens? If you haven't set the rule, it's not rebellion. It's not disobedience. But if you set a rule that says, I want to be able to say, please come back or stop or whatever, one time, and that's it. And if you don't do that, there's a consequence. And it's repeated, and it's consistent. Doesn't matter whether in the grocery store or in the backyard in private. It's a consistent rule. And so you set that rule. And now when it is disobeyed, you can be very confident that's folly. That's the difference. It depends on whether there's a rule or not. And, you know, I can talk about that safety. It seemed like, well, that might be one of the rules for the child's safety, far beyond car seat construction, where if you could train a child, when you say stop, John, they stop. Would that be a safety thing, you think? You would think, like, you walk in the city or whatever, if they could just, but if they've learned that it's the third try and the tone of voice has to exceed 110 decibels, that's when you really have to stop, you know. You've trained them that way, and or maybe it never matters. Yeah. Yeah, right, right. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Right, and so, you know, somebody said, well, how early? I think you start looking for the P thing where you get the behavior demonstrates that I know this is a test of will. And I think it's a natural experimentation. But that's the early opportunity to start doing that kind of folly removal, extraction, detanglement, to use the Holman translation. Okay, how about this? 5-year-old child does not put on his seatbelt. You're getting the idea. Sorry, you get the idea, right? 5 years old, though, man. 5 years old and still doesn't do it, you know. A 4-year-old trips and hurts his baby sister. 4-year-old trips, yeah. He trips and hurts his baby sister. Now, all of these are depends to some extent. But let's say this is an accident. But the baby sister's hurt and she's crying, right? 4-year-old spills milk for the third time at dinner. Again, is there a rule? Have we pushed this into the realm of folly by having a very consistent set of instructions? 6-year-old breaks his own toy, but he denies doing it. That's a problem. Right? 3-year-old blurts out an embarrassing family secret to a stranger. Wait till we get home. It's not folly, okay? Kids don't know, but what everything's fair to talk about. And an 8-year-old, unless you tell them at home, hey, we have secret. No, that's not a good idea. 8-year-old tries to help with yard work, but damages a tool. Boy, damaged my tool. That makes me angry. My tools are my manly things, you know? And does not follow instructions and damages a yard tool. Okay, a little different. 5-year-old says a bad word that he has learned from school. Time for the, this is old timey. Well, time for the soap. Remember what the soap was for? Right. No, you know, a 7-year-old is found watching TV before his or her chores are done. You kind of get the idea. If you haven't decided what the rules and constraints are, then you really can't define it as rebellion. On the other hand, if you haven't defined any rules or any constraints, then you haven't helped the child learn about obedience and listening and discipline and authority and those kind of things. Sure. Yes. And I think as you grow, you slowly, with this more strategic view of life, you understand that if I don't wear my coat, I probably will be cold, right? Or if I'm not careful with my milk, I'll spill it again and I'll be embarrassed or whatever. But yeah, I think ideally, though, it's not the spilling of the milk. It's whatever that precursor rule that was made to prevent spilling of the milk. When that's broken, that's where it ought to happen, not just because some bad consequence occurred. Okay. Let's keep on going. I'm really getting close. So here's what punishment should be. It should be for folly, but not for, okay? Here are all the things that we tend to be tempted to do. Maybe even men have a worse time. I don't know. Maybe frazzled moms have the worst problem. I don't know. But it's not for accident. It's not for clumsiness. It's not because they don't know or they don't have the ability. It's not as a show to others, especially other parents or preachers or somebody. It's not showing our personal disappointment with them. You get the silent treatment because you struck out four times. Yeah, I wish it weren't so, but that's not it. Our own embarrassment, our own impatience, as a warning. This I like that, right? They're just getting out of control. Somebody needs to get a spanking so they'll calm down, right? Or, you know, just to settle things down, they're out of control. I think it's the same. An accumulation of small things, you know, like this is the last straw. Now, that last straw was not actually an act of rebellion, but it did spill the milk. So I've had it. That's enough. I believe that's teaching this kind of bad male character that we've talked about before. But it should be associated with personal guilt, not a corporate, all you kids are getting it because somebody did it or whatever, or circumstantial blame. It should be certain when promised. It seems to me the worst thing to do is to threaten a consequence that doesn't happen. Not the worst, but that's way worse than not having any consequence at all because it's teaching an inconsistency. I think that's what leads sometimes to frustration and discouragement. And no second chances. I think it's Scott Smeltzer. Is he the one that does the parenting things? Have you heard some of his stuff, Scott? So he asked everybody to try to think of the shortest statement to summarize discipline. And some lady came up with this. First time obedience. Three words. So you ask something, and whatever you've done up to that point, it means you don't have to ask again. It happens right away. It's the first time. That's kind of his summary. No second chances. And because, you know, it's just you're teaching something that's not there. It's near to the infraction, especially when younger. Sometimes the natural consequence. It needs to be something painful. And by the way, it should be kind of substantially more painful than the enjoyment the kid got out of whatever he did wrong, right? It may be worth it to whatever they did. Just, hey, yeah, a couple of licks, that's no big deal. Or quiet time, I can handle that, you know. It's just worth it. Of course, it doesn't mean physically painful. Yeah, right. Yeah, that's right. I will say that talking to a 14-month-old has its limits. Yeah, so, to a 14-year-old has its limits too, probably. So it needs to have some degree of consequence. I think that's the idea of the rod. So here's it's over quickly, forgotten, once done. You know, we always talk about the negative side. There's a whole antimatter world to this. You know what I mean? That is punishment for rebellion, for folly, all those things. What's the antimatter world to that? Praise for the good things, for the other side, for wisdom, self-control, obedience, respect, morality when it's tough, those kind of things. So I think we should think about the antimatter world for wise behavior, compliance, respectfulness, politeness, for personal goodness. And by the way, if you say, you know, if you can do this, there's a reward, that should be just as certain as the painfulness, right? And the only difference, really, it's a big difference, and that is this discipline should be over quickly, once done, forgotten, right? It's for the present, Hebrews 12 says. Praise, however, I think could be extended, celebrated, repeated, reviewed, right? Put up on the bulletin board to stay for months at a time because of its lasting effect. That's the one difference that's not quite the same. But it also needs to be continual and consistent, just like he who loves his son disciplines him betimes, constantly, diligently. There. So I have a little checklist here. I hope that comes up next. And that is this. And then we're getting close to being done. Here's a way to think about corporal punishment. And I'm going to contrast this with the Pediatric Association's view of this. But before the event, we've talked about all these things. It might be a good thing to ask this question. Is there a rule about the desired behavior that's clear? And this is an observable behavior. I think something like, I just don't like your tone, is probably getting a little bit questionable. But something objective. It is or it isn't obeyed. I think that should be in place. Maybe even to the point that the child himself could repeat the rule. He could actually say, no, no, when dad says come, I have to come the first time. Maybe he's even to the point where he could repeat that rule and know it's so. It may be by his behavior he demonstrates he's aware of the rule. That's the looking up from the gravity experiment to say, I know this is wrong. I know this. I've already been talked to about this. And not only that, is a punishment known and understood, maybe warned of in advance, and maybe even for a little bit older children, they know what the rule is and what the consequence is as well. Okay, now here comes the infraction. Is the disobedience obvious and known and maybe even admitted by the child? And is it folly? That's our question, right? Or is it an accident or incompetence or forgetfulness or whatever? But is it evidence of rebellion or laziness or disrespect or stubbornness or other foolishness? Now, it seems to me that provoking our children to wrath might be done by demonstrating wrath. So I'm going to suggest this is like the trumpets in Revelation or something. We'll have an interlude before the seventh seal is opened or something, right? And the interlude has this. Am I calm? Maybe I discuss things with my spouse. And not only am I calm, do I appear calm. And it seems to me that's going to be a huge lesson to the child, that these are rules that are not related to my own welfare, to my self-centeredness, to my inconvenience. They're related to something that's bigger and deeper than that, and that's your wisdom and a spiritual purpose behind it. So now here's the prelude to punishment. I've reviewed the rule, the disobedience, previously determined and stated, and we review what's been said before. What did we say would happen? You know, what did you do? I express my love, and I also may even explain that the reason I'm doing this is because I love you. In fact, I might even go further and say that I'm hurt about this. I hate that I have to punish you, but you know what? I have rules to obey just like you do, and I'm having to do this, even though I don't prefer. It's kind of a little bit of an analogy to what you did, and you would need to obey it with regard to my. And then the red line, you know what the red line is. That's when it happens. There's whatever the actual punishment is. After, have I expressed confidence that my child is capable of better behavior? And finally, have I expressed and demonstrated my willingness to forgive quickly, including physical touch, hugging, and so on? If you've done something like this and taken the time to work through it, I'll tell you that last step is one of the most moving experiences you can have. I think the child too. And that is to say, we worked through this. It's over. And you're just great, and we love you so much. And this is my demonstration of that. Yep.
So I agree with this. And I guess my personal experience with one of my kids has been, they recognize the checklist is beginning.
Yeah.
Right? And so I would say, y'all know Jack. When Jack recognizes the checklist is beginning, he doesn't, you know, necessarily, okay, now we're going to have a talk about what I do. He just, when I say, Jack, go to your room and wait for me for a minute, don't spank me, don't spank me, don't spank me, don't spank me, don't spank me. And that doesn't stop.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So after the spanking is over, so I don't really get to talk about him and express all stuff, right?
yeah.
So I have to rearrange the checklist a bit.
Yeah. So I wish we had time to do this perfectly every time. Yeah. And maybe it's not appropriate. This is not quite on that point, but I did have a young dad at Embry Hills come to me as if I knew what to say, which I don't usually. But he said, you know, I have a problem with Logan. He says, he just flips out on things. He starts screaming. and things that they may scare him, but he just goes overboard and he just keeps on going. You know, it's kind of like a panic tantrum or something like that, you know. And of course, it's often in public and all that. And he said, is that folly or not? Yeah, right. So I think the answer is I don't know. He doesn't know. Maybe you don't know. Is there a way to make it folly, to move it into the area of folly, so that now we kind of do know it is folly? Is there a way to do that? I'm not sure this is the answer, but I'm saying think about that. There may be behaviors. I think etiquette comes in this category. You know, you want the kid to look the adult in the eye and say, hello, what's your name? And it's a natural thing. They bury their head in mom's skirt, you know, and they're rolling on the floor and all this kind of stuff. I think because they get more attention that way. I don't know what causes them to do that. My theories are that. Is that folly? I don't think so. I think it's a natural reaction, and maybe they've been trained to do that by some strange reinforcement that we don't know. But could we move it into the realm of folly if that's an important behavior that we wish them to develop? Could we do that? I mean, it's a theory. I don't know. Could I say, look, here's the way you interact with adults. We're going to practice this time. And tomorrow at church, we're going to see how we do this. And once that's learned and we understand it, we might even attach a consequence to it over time. Now when it doesn't happen, maybe there's forgetfulness at first, but when it doesn't happen, it is folly because you've tried to set a rule in that area. I mean, it's the same thing, running out in the street. Other things are natural to them, but you've kind of pushed them into the realm of folly for their own good. That's the point. So I don't know if that would work or not, but say, hey, stop screaming, don't spank me. I'm going to spank you more next time you do that. Yeah. Yeah, so one of the guys at church, he has four boys, imagine that, and they're all pretty close in age, and so they're wild, you know, I mean, just because they're boys, and there, a lot of them are in the same room, and he said, you got to clean your room. And so he has this thing where he sets his iPhone timer to 5 minutes. He says, if he's on the room clean in 5 minutes, everybody gets a spanking, you know. So he puts it in there, turns it on. And so he decided from that the timer was a real motivator. You know what I mean? It's like there's a time. You can see it ticking down. It makes them keep busy. So he went in the other night and he said, okay, guys. He thought the timer was the trick. You know what I mean? And he said, okay, you got 2 minutes to clean the room. But he didn't say, I'm going to spank you if you don't. He just said, you just got 2 minutes. Let's set the timer, see if that helps you, you know. Well, the second youngest just fell out. He started crying and bawling because he thought he was on the track like you just described. You know what I mean? Because he knew they couldn't clean the room in 2 minutes, you know. And he remembered the five-minute thing and what happened, you know. And all he saw the timer again, you know. And, yeah, yeah.
He's done.
Yeah, that's right. It's over. There's no way. So interesting. Did the projector go off? Thank you. Yeah. So there it is. I'm going to skip this one. I think we can kind of tell the difference now between chastening and abuse. If it's out of anger, there's no rule. It's for my convenience. It's for my embarrassment. It's to show my macho, no, don't mess with me. That's abuse. It doesn't matter whether you hit them or not. If you're just yelling and all it is a expression of my revenge or my power or something like that, I think that's abuse. Now, back to the question I asked earlier. Is there ever a time really to express temper as a parent? I don't fully know the answer, but I think maybe not. Especially, for sure, I will say this. If it has to do with protecting my rights and my respect, that's absolutely wrong. All you're doing is teaching selfishness. Maybe there's a case to say, you do not talk to your mom that way. Maybe there's a time for that. I don't know. That's a harder one. But there may be some purpose in emphasizing that point. Here's what the American Association of Pediatrics, the experts, say. There's perhaps no more controversial form of discipline than spanking. The AAP disapproves of spanking under any circumstances. Here are the reasons. So this is important to know these expert reasons for why spanking under any circumstances is wrong, bad. Spanking teaches children that it's okay to hit when they're angry. In other words, I'm angry, I hit you, what am I teaching them? When you get angry, you're supposed to hit people. How do you respond to that? Don't do it when you're angry. That's not when it should happen. Spanking can physically harm the children. If you beat your child, he will not die. Discipline your child, and you will save his soul from death. Interesting two proverbs back to back there. Of course, you don't physically harm the child. Rather than teaching children how to change their behavior, spanking makes them fearful of their parents and teaches them merely to avoid getting caught. Now, you see, part of the reason in those checklists, that affirmation, that forgiveness, that's the way we need to live with each other. I think that's a lesson that they'll miss learning. In the case of children who are looking for attention by acting out, spanking may reward them by giving them attention. Negative attention is better than no attention at all. So anyway, some points, which you probably already know, don't spank in anger. You will not die. And the same problems, it seems to me, in these latter two things, they exist with all forms of unpleasant consequences. Whether it's timeout or loneliness or you have to not play the video game for 5 whole minutes, you have to give it up, or some other thing. It's really the same issue. Is this the way we respond to things, by some striking back? You've got to move it out of that room, Jeff. Yeah. Good. Yeah. I have that whole antimatter world of praise that's in place. It's in this larger context. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It's a constant experiment, but I do think these guidelines that wisdom, I think the key verse is, folly is bound up in the heart of a child. It's entangled in his heart. And it cannot be left alone. It has to be addressed. It is much more cruel to leave a child alone with that folly and allow him to grow up with that selfishness, that self-centeredness, that I don't need to listen to the world attitude, which is kind of the worldview most people have, unfortunately. I think the worldview is that, hey, they're just like puppies. They live in a world. They were made to live in this world. They evolved here. They'll figure it out. Is that the Bible view of this fallen world? That's what I've been trying to say from the beginning. No, we're kind of at war. And our strategies and our courage, I'm sorry, I cut you off, but they need to be directed toward the real war, not our self-centered survival in a physical fallen world. Yeah. Right. It attaches. No, none of it, not at all. And I've seen the little, documentaries where they go and find, a couple of folks in a double wide somewhere, they're whacking their kids against the wall, and that's the kind of the paradigm. This is what, is this what we do? This is why. Yeah, nothing against double wides. I meant the people were double. I didn't mean the house. Sorry, there's no way out of that. Were you going to say something? The double wide. Oh. Yeah. Right, I'd mash that together with Jeff's comment. So if you have this time of praise and positive, that's where you learn about them.
My wife, her dad never had to lay a hand on her. All he had to do was look at her. Mm-hmm. That was just her. So it's a combination of the physical, the need for physical discipline is there.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. 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 I see a little bit of a contradiction in the third and fourth point, because it seems to be saying that there is actually this implicit desire for attention, as opposed to this idea that we're making them afraid of us. I don't know how you mix those together, but those two seem a little bit
common.
Yeah, right. There's a, yeah, right. Learns about them. Becomes omniscient like God, knowing our needs. Yeah. That's a good point. Yeah, yeah, that's right. Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But where will society go in this? Where are there are laws being passed, you know. I'm sorry, we're at war. We'll be spoken of as evildoers. We have a worldview that's offensive to many people. They think it's strange that we don't run with them, and they'll speak evil of us various ways. Now here's where we as men can show courage, I think. Not only not this little issue here, but just in general. In the priorities we set, and the way we handle difficulties in our family and our with our wives. And okay, this is not the normal ending, but I am going to end I hope some of this is fit together a little bit. God made us in a special way. In some way, He has called men. He knows us. He's given us our character to be in these roles in the way we should be. But the world has fallen, and it makes it harder. But I think those essential male elements of wanting to succeed, of wanting to control in a positive way, to create things that are good, right? Should be directed, that courage, and maybe even the excitement and danger and risk that could be directed towards spiritual things in our relationships with our family, with our kids. We didn't get to the church, right? But it still seemed like that's a challenging place as well, helping our fellow brethren. I hope this fit together a little bit. Like I say, look at the charts. Maybe there'll be some stuff you can study later and figure out how to make it better or something. I'm done.